I will say a bit more about singularity theorems in cosmology, but then we will focus on black holes and a little bit about singularity theorems for black holes. So let's assume that a set of symmetries of matter and space-time has been assumed. And let's assume that on the basis of the symmetry assumptions, we found exact solutions. Or even if we weren't able to find an exact solution, we might have found at least asymptotic properties of these solutions. And then let's assume that we choose a time-like congruence of geodesics again. Remember, these were these spaghettis of geodesics. Now, in these circumstances, we can now explicitly calculate the twist of these geodesics, the way that they rotate around each other, the shear in which these, let's say, a circle of geodesics would get squeezed in one direction and expand in the other direction, or also the expansion of the congruence of geodesics, which means an overall enlargement or shrinkage of any circle of geodesics. But we can do this with a finer resolution still. What we are aiming for now is the Hubble functions. Remember, there is a Hubble parameter, which describes, in the case of Friedmann, Robertson, Walker, Lemaître spacetimes, the expansion, just the scale factor A. But that assumes, as is the case for FIW spacetimes, it assumes isotropy and homogeneity. A universe, however, can expand in different directions at different rates. And so you can have different expansion rates, different expansion factors, different Hubble parameters that describe A dot over A in different directions. And that's, of course, related to these expansion and shear parameters. So in particular, we can see how the expansion or contraction of the universe behaves dynamically, especially when the conditions of perfect isotropy and homogeneity are relaxed. Now we can have different expansions in different directions. And because the Einstein equations are highly nonlinear, because the metric occurs in all sorts of ways in there, we can have that the expansion and shrinkage rates in different directions can influence each other in a nonlinear fashion. Now let's remember one thing, for example. We remember that shear, in particular, can only shrink in one direction if in another direction we have an expansion. That's different with the overall expansion factor, which can shrink or expand in all directions at the same time. If you remember, this showed up in the tracelessness of the shear, and then we also had the traceful part that geodesic deviation matrix B, and that was describing the overall expansion or overall shrinkage. So now we consider the rate of expansion tensor that includes shear. So this is now not necessarily trace-free anymore. So this theta mu nu is the shear tensor, which, if you remember, was traceless, so a shrinkage in one direction meant an expansion in the other, in some other direction. But here we also have now the expansion scalar. This is a traceful part. So the whole thing is simply the symmetric part of the geodesic deviation matrix B. There was the anti-symmetric part that described the Lorentz transformation, which in our case was only spatial, therefore a rotation. And then the symmetric part is this, and it contains the traceless part and the traceful part. Remember what H was doing? H is the projector onto the space-like hypersurfaces that are orthogonal to the direction of the geodesics. So this tensor here, theta mu nu, is fully space-like and symmetric, and therefore it can be diagonalized in a suitable orthonormal frame. So we can find basis vectors in the tangent space such that this symmetric part of the geodesic deviation matrix is diagonal. And since it's only going in the spatial directions, it only has contributions theta 1, theta 2, theta 3, in the three spatial directions. So we have the three expansions in the three basic directions. These are, of course, time dependent, right? Time and space dependent. So the overall expansion is then theta 1 plus theta 2 plus theta 3, because it's the trace of this, right? The trace full part was what we call just the expansion parameter, and that's the trace of that, which is the sum of the three. Now we can define a local Hubble expansion function for each one of these principal directions, the directions that happen to diagonalize at this particular place, in this particular time, our symmetric matrix theta. In those principal directions, we can define the local Hubble expansion functions. And we define also the overall local Hubble expansion as a third of the sum of the three. Which is, you know, a third, because that gives you the average of these three, right? That's why there's a third. Theta is the sum of the three, and then the third. So this gives you the average Hubble expansion. Okay, so if we use the HI and H to define local directional scale factors. If you want to do this, we can do it in the same way that we did it for the isotropic case. In the isotropic case, the Hubble parameter was A dot over A. And in the non-isotropic case, as we have here, we do this simply for each of the principal directions separately. So each L plays the role of a scale factor A, but it's associated to one of the principal directions. So we have the L1 dot over L1 is the HI, and so on. And we also have it for the average. Here the time derivative, the dot, is defined by applying the time direction as defined by our congruence of geodesics. Remember, the U vector field was the vector field of tangent vectors to our spaghetti of geodesics. So this vector field is time-like because we are dealing with geodesics that could actually be traveled by objects. Therefore, we can always find a coordinate system such that this is literally the time derivative with respect to this coordinate system, because the u will just be 1, 0, 0, 0, and therefore this just becomes d by dx naught in that coordinate system. So then, what have we done now? What have we arrived at? Well, we have now a description of cosmologies, which is a little bit more general than the FRW case. Because, not just a little bit, it's much more general. Because instead of just having one expansion parameter A, we now have expansion parameters for each direction, each principal direction, and they can depend on space and time. And also the principal directions can depend on space and time. And then we can ask, what kind of singularities can we have now? You see, for FRW spacetime, we may or may not have a singularity. If we have a power law expansion, then there is generally an expansion. There is generally a singularity at the beginning. If we have an exponential expansion, then we don't have a singularity at the beginning. If we can just follow that exponential behavior of the scale factor arbitrarily far back in time, and there was never a singularity. But now that we have the possibility that space-time behaves differently in different directions, we can ask what kind of singularities can now occur. You could imagine, for example, that in one direction, in one principal direction, you have a singularity, in another we don't. The full set of cases that the Einstein equation allows to occur with reasonable assumptions about the matter content is not yet known. But explicit examples of weird singularities are known. Explicit solutions are known. One situation is a situation that we know of already from Friedman, Lemaître, Roberts, and Walker solutions, and they are when all of the scale factors, that is to say for each principal direction, goes to zero, just like in these Friedman, Lemaître cosmologies. So the universe shrinks as you follow it back in time, shrinks in all dimensions, in all directions, so that the scale factor goes to zero. But you can also have that, for example, only two of the scale factors go to zero, and one actually goes to infinity. Now that's a weird singularity, which is called a cigar singularity, right? Because it's very long and thin. In one direction, space-time actually expands, that's the length of the cigar. And in two other directions, the cross-section of the cigar, space-time actually contracts to zero. That's a cigar singularity. But you can also have that the cross-section shrinks to zero in two dimensions, and in the third dimension, it doesn't actually diverge, but it goes to a constant. In this case, it's called the barrel singularity because it's like a barrel of a finite size. It has a finite length, but the cross-section shrinks to zero. You can also have that in two of the principal directions, the space-time reaches a constant extent, constant scaling, but in the third direction it shrinks to singularity. In this case, the universe would end up in a pancake. Sort of a dimensional reduction of it. And of course, for FRW models, these L's reduce to the usual scale factor A. All right, so now let's move on to black holes. I will first study the Schwarzschild black hole in various coordinate systems, and then I will describe some of the concepts that come along with black holes, in particular the concept of trapped surfaces, because they are then needed for singularity theorems for black holes. We won't actually get into the details of these theorems, but we will address the kind of assumption that go into the formulation of singularity theorems for black holes. So in 1915, Schwarzschild found this solution to the Einstein equations. And of course, you've seen that before, so that's the Schwarzschild black hole, a non-rotating black hole in the coordinates in which Schwarzschild first found it. Now clearly, this thing has a singularity at r equals to zero, and it has a horizon at an event horizon at r equal to m. And here the coordinates little t, little r, phi, and theta are called the Schwarzschild coordinates. Fortunately, the Schwarzschild coordinates have long misled intuition because for a long time it was thought that the fact that this term blows up at r going to 2m, because this is an inverse here, this goes to zero, that fact led people to believe that there's a singularity there, not just in the matrix formulation, but in the spacetime itself. But then later it was shown that that's not the case. You can calculate The Riemann curvature tensor for all r values, including r equal to 2m, and it is finite. So there is not actually singularity, it's just an unlucky choice of coordinates. You can take even Minkowski space and write it down in coordinates that have singularities. So the space-time is actually doing fine, it just has a horizon there, but there is no singularity. And in fact, as we will soon see, we can choose different coordinates in which the metric is regular at 2m. Now, another weird feature of the Schwarzschild black hole when you write it down in the Schwarzschild coordinates is that the metric changes sign in the first two terms. Let's just have a look at this again. This is this computer again that doesn't want to go back. How can we do this? I can't do it. I don't know how to backtrack on this machine. Okay, if you remember from the metric, there were these terms 1 over 2m over r. And depending on whether r was larger or smaller than 2m, these terms changed sign. And what that meant is that the dt squared term changed sign as you went from outside the horizon to inside the horizon, and also the dr squared term changed sign as you did. But that is important because it means that r is a space-like variable, the space-like coordinate, only outside the horizon, only for r larger than 2m. So the tangent d by dr is only space-like outside the horizon. And inside the horizon, it is time-like. And the reverse is true for t. The tangent vector d by dt is time-like outside the horizon, but space-like inside. Now that leads to the phenomenon that inside the horizon, r is the time variable, because it is the time-like variable. You can choose a coordinate system such that d by dr takes the coordinates 1, 0, 0, 0, 0. So r is a time variable, and t is the space, is a spatial variable. And to see that this has concrete implications, let us look, for example, at a traveler, let's call her Alice, who is freely falling from some distance away from the black hole, towards the black hole, crosses the horizon, and eventually makes it all the way to the singularity. I plotted for you here in a space-time diagram using the Schwarzschild coordinates, r and t, how that looks like, how that trajectory looks like. So Alice starts out at time equals zero, at radius r naught. And we assume that that radius is much larger than the Schwarzschild radius of 2m. So Alice is now freely falling. Initially, she is very far away from the black hole. Therefore, and she's at rest initially. Okay, so she starts at rest, and then she just freely falls towards the black hole, being attracted by the black hole. So she starts at rest, which means that her initial velocity is zero. And far from the black hole, the Schwarzschild coordinates are basically Minkowski coordinates. Far from the black hole, the space-time is Minkowski space-time, and the Schwarzschild coordinates are the usual coordinates of Minkowski space. So this initial part of the trajectory is just as we would expect. The trajectory goes up vertically, initially, because Alice is only traveling in time. She's sitting there, not having any velocity. She only acquires velocity over time as the black hole attracts her. So she's moving like this, picking up speed. Okay, and she starts going like this. But then it kicks in that the coordinate system is weird. And because the coordinate system is weird,
What happens is that the trajectory goes like this, and in fact, goes all the way up to infinity. What that means is that as Alice is traveling this path, and her radius, her distance from the center of the black hole, as measured by the Schwarzschild R, as that distance is decreasing and she's approaching the horizon, her time coordinate in the Schwarzschild time actually starts going to infinity, which means that it actually takes an infinite amount of Schwarzschild time for Alice to reach the Schwarzschild horizon. That doesn't mean that Alice has to wait a long time, because according to her onboard wristwatch, this takes only a finite amount of time. In fact, I gave you here the exact formulas so that you can plot this thing yourself and play with it if you like. So here, alpha is a parameter of that geodesic, and then you have r of alpha, the radius as a function of alpha, t of alpha, and tau of alpha, tau being the wristwatch time of Alice. So this is how this looks like. And this is just how Alice falls towards the black hole. So she reaches the horizon at a finite time on her wristwatch. But according to the way we assign t and r values to events in Schwarzschild spacetime according to Schwarzschild's coordinates, it takes an infinite amount of Schwarzschild coordinate time, but these are not reasonable clocks anyway. Well, and then what? Well, then Alice crosses the horizon and her geodesic continues inside the black hole towards the singularity until she hits the singularity at a finite time. At a finite time on her wristwatch. Again, you can track all of this in this expression here. But what happens to her t and r coordinates? When she's inside the black hole, her r parameter decreases towards r equals zero. Right? So r from here to there. But notice that the time parameter runs from infinity to a finite point in time. Her Schwarzschild time runs backwards. But that shouldn't concern us because it's not a time. It's actually a space variable. It's a space-like variable. D by dt is a tangent vector, which inside the black hole is space-like. You can always find a coordinate system in which it has the coordinates 0, 1, 1, 1, 0, 1, 0, 0. Whereas d by dr is time-like. So what we learn from this is, in particular, that we shouldn't really use the Schwarzschild coordinates too much because they are not very intuitive. Instead, there are better coordinate systems. In particular, Alice might want to use another coordinate system that is appropriate for her point of view. And then there could be another observer, Bob, who is, let's say, very far away from the black hole in a region where there's basically Minkowski space. And Bob may have other requirements on a coordinate system. So let's see, what would be the most useful kind of coordinate system from the perspective of somebody who is freely falling into the black hole? And what would be the most appropriate kind of coordinate system for someone, let's call him Bob, who is observing the whole situation from far away where we have Minkowski space? So we will do two coordinate systems now, one optimized for Alice and one optimized for Bob. So in preparation, let's first simplify the situation by dropping the variables phi and theta to make the whole thing a two-dimensional slice. And remember why it is useful to take a space-time and slice it into a one plus one-dimensional one, or two-dimensional one. Remember, that's because in two dimensions,
curvature is scalar. That was the key observation that led to Penrose diagram, because we can always find a conformally equivalent space-time in two dimensions that has the same causal structure. So in two dimensions, we know that any curvature is conformally equivalent to Minkowski space, or at least part of Minkowski space. So any in two dimensions, any metric is up to a scalar prefactor that may depend on space and time, proportional to eta, the metric of Minkowski space. So by dropping these two coordinates, we get that benefit. And we use that now to design a coordinate system that is optimal from Alice's perspective. So imagine now an Alice, which I should say, we changed a little bit the scenario here, because here Alice starts her free fall somewhere outside the black hole. But where should we have her start her free fall? Well, there's one particular point where it would be interesting to start the free fall, and that would be at the horizon. So let us assume we're now looking at an Alice who starts her free fall right at the horizon. What would be for this Alice an optimal kind of coordinate system to investigate what's going on? Well, first of all, Alice would want a coordinate system such that the metric is, of course, regular across r equal to m. If it is true what I claimed before, that there is no singularity at the horizon, then it should be possible to choose a coordinate system where g mu nu is regular across 2m. But then, because of the equivalence principle, it should also be possible to find a coordinate system in which the metric not only doesn't blow up at the horizon, no, it ought to be the Minkowski metric at the horizon. Right? We should be able to build a Riemann normal coordinate system even right on the horizon. Now, Alice wants her stuff really clean and optimized, so she insists on that and says, all right, I want a coordinate system in which the metric at her starting point, at her starting event, when she starts freely falling into the black hole, to be actually eta mu nu on the horizon. That ought to be possible. And then she says, okay, I want the coordinate system to be such that the metric is regular across the horizon, that the metric is actually the same of Minkowski space at the horizon itself, and I want the coordinate system to be such that the metric is some scalar prefactor times eta mu nu. So she wants the metric to be diagonalized everywhere already, which again, in two dimensions, we know should always be possible. So these are quite some steep requirements, but you can do it. And here is Alice's choice of coordinates. These are the so-called Kruskal-Szekeres coordinates. And while the Schwarzschild coordinates were traditionally called little t and little r, the Kruskal-Szekeres coordinates that Alice would prefer typically have the name capital T and capital R. And capital T and capital R are defined in this complicated way in terms of the little t and little r. But you see, in principle, you can now pick any event on the Schwarzschild space-time, pick its coordinates rt, little r, little t, and calculate what its coordinates capital T, capital R are going to be. It's going to be a little bit messy, but you can do it. Notice that these theta functions here are Heaviside theta functions, and they distinguish the case inside and outside the horizon. Outside the horizon, r is larger than 2m, and we have this term times 1, and that term is gone, because this theta has a negative argument, so it's 0. And here, the same thing. Outside the horizon, this term is present, and inside the horizon, that term is present. Now, it turns out, with a lot of work, you can show that this map is invertible, in principle. Although it's terrible to actually do it, but in principle, this map is invertible. So you can also obtain the little t and little r in terms of Alice's Kruskal-Szekeres coordinates. But why did we do this? Well, we did it because Alice wanted a metric, the metric in a particular standard form. And that's indeed achieved here. If you make this change of coordinates, you apply this diffeomorphism to your coordinate system, then the metric looks like this. And that obeys all the requirements. First of all, at r equal to 2m, what do we have? We have that if r is equal to 2m, then this is 1, this is e to the power 0, so this is just 1, and this is 1. And so we just have dt squared minus dr squared, which is eta mu nu. So right on the horizon, the metric takes the form of the Minkowski metric. Away from the horizon, it's not like that. Away from the horizon, we have this prefactor, but that's just a scalar function, just some scalar function of capital T and capital R, multiplying the Minkowski metric as Alice desired. Now, in practice, though, it's hard to actually write this down explicitly, because, well, it looks like it's explicit and it looks like it's simple, but it's not, because here we have R of T and R. Remember, here we are expressing capital T and capital R in terms of the little t and little r. You would have to invert this map in order to get little r in terms of T and R, but that's what you would need in here. So this is an implicit description of what the metric is. But in principle, you can do this, and at least numerically, you can always do that. So how does the world look like to Alice now, when she uses this coordinate system? Okay, so here we have again our space variable, and here we have our time variable, and they are space and time variables. Because, look at it, r and t don't change character here. You see, this is always some positive prefactor multiplying the Minkowski metric. So this is always time-like, this is always space-like. So therefore, whether we are inside or outside the horizon, this is always space-like, this is always time-like. Also, because the metric is now some prefactor times the Minkowski metric, we have that the light cones are like this, everywhere. Everywhere the light cones are like that. That's very useful to study the causal structure of this. Now, there's a lot going on here. Let me explain. So Alice now is starting at t equals 0, capital T equals 0, capital R equal to 0. That is where capital R equal to 0 is at the horizon. That's where she starts. And then she travels forward in time and arrives at the singularity. Surfaces of constant r are described like this. They are hyperbolas here. And inside the horizon, they look like that. See, the horizon is here. That's the event horizon. Any observer who is in here, somewhere in this triangle, any observer here can only travel upwards because the light cone is like this. This is the forward light cone, right? Any observer in here can only travel upwards and will hit eventually the singularity at the center of the black hole. The singularity being this line. Not a point, it's a line. So if you are anywhere in here, you're lost. You're going to make it to the singularity. If, however, you are outside, you're somewhere here, well then, remember your light cone is like this, right? That's your light cone, which means you have a choice. Let's say you're a friend of Alice. You're here. Your light cone looks like this. which means you can travel forward in time with a direction anywhere between here and there. You may choose to travel this way. It doesn't mean you're going to meet Alice, right? But it means you're going to hit the singularity. See, you're not intersecting with Alice. But you could also choose to be a survivor of this situation, and then within, you can choose a trajectory where all tangent vectors are within the forward light cone, and you can escape the black hole. Okay, so for Alice, the space-time looks like this. And remember, the metric, the underlying metric in this space is simply a prefactor, a scalar prefactor times the Minkowski metric. And that's the causal structure of it. And there's nothing here. If you map the Schwarzschild spacetime into Alice's Kruskal-Szekeres coordinates, this is all there is. All of the Schwarzschild spacetime is only this. It doesn't map into anything here. All the events are over there. You just add that Alice was addressed at the event horizon, right? She started here and then fell that way. And the singularity here has a known curve. A T of R of the singularity is R squared plus 16 M squared over E to the power of 1/2. A coordinate system that is very useful for the purposes of tracing rays and for the purposes of quantum field theory are so-called light cone coordinates. I don't know, have you all seen light cone coordinates before? No? Okay. So if you have a time variable and a space variable, you can switch to new variables, which are the sum and the difference between this time and the space variable. So the difference between time and the space, the time and the space variable might be called u, and the sum of the two might be called v. Obviously, that's a simple change of coordinates, it's linear, and you can go back and forth, right? If you know the u and v coordinates, you can calculate what the t and r coordinates are and vice versa. It's a very simple change of coordinates. But it does a tremendous job. And the job that it does is that it actually turns equations of motion that are second order kind of to the equations of motion that are first order. And that can be very useful. Let's investigate what the equations of motion look like if we use the u and v variables. So first of all, the metric. In terms of the u and v variables, becomes this one, where the scalar prefactor is obtained by expressing little r in terms of u and v and little r in terms of u and v, which is a hell of a job to do, right? Because you have to express little r first in t and capital T in capital R, which is very difficult, and then you express those in terms of the little u and little v. Analytically, super difficult, but numerically trivial. And then the dt squared minus dr squared measure of Minkowski space becomes du dv. That's the reason why light cone coordinates are of interest, as we will see in a moment. So let us consider now the action for a field that lives on that space-time. Two-dimensional, so we do d2x, which is really little x and little t. And that's the general formula for the action, right? Klein-Gordon action for a massless field. Here we have the metric, and here the first derivative square root of g. And this could be really any coordinate system. This is how the Klein-Gordon action for a massless scalar field looks like in every coordinate system. Now, in particular, if we choose the coordinate system of Alice with the capital T and capital R, then the action will look like this.
The only difference to the case of Minkowski space will be that there is a restriction. I mean, the capital T is larger minus R, because if you remember, all of the space-time is mapped onto just this upper triangle, rather than also the lower part. And then if we change to the U and V coordinates, the light cone coordinates, then, well, just remember, if you take U times V, what's that? That's T minus R times T plus R, which is T squared minus R squared. And so what you get is that here we have dt squared minus dr squared in the light cone coordinates becomes du phi dv phi. And that means that the Klein-Gordon equation now takes this simple form. Because, you know, if you calculate the Euler-Lagrange equation, then you have to take the functional derivative with respect to one variable and then differentiate with respect to the other. So what you get is this, which contains no second derivatives in V and no second derivatives in U, only first derivative in V and the first derivative in U. And that, as we will see, for example, next term, is useful for quantization. Now let's look at Bob's choice of coordinate system. So Bob lives somewhere out there, far away from the black hole. And Bob says, I don't like the Schwarzschild coordinates either. I want a coordinate system in which the metric takes the form of the Minkowski metric as we go far away from the black hole, as we go to where Bob lives. And Bob wants that the metric is still diagonalized everywhere else. It's just the Minkowski metric multiplied with some scalar prefactor. This is convenient for Bob because, first of all, where Bob lives, far away from the black hole, everything is just like Minkowski coordinates in Minkowski space-time. It also means that for Bob, photons travel at 45 degrees. That is to say, the light cones are always looking like that everywhere in the space-time, just because the metric takes this form. It's a multiple of the Minkowski metric. So that means that the causal structure is going to be clear everywhere, easily. And the equations of motion of matter can again be simplified because Bob is anticipating that he too can do this trick with light cone coordinates. Bob's choice of coordinates is called the tortoise coordinate system. And here is how we get those. The tortoise coordinates are called little t star and little r star. And they are related to the Schwarzschild coordinates in this way. It's a slightly simpler transformation. The tortoise coordinate time t star is actually the same as the Schwarzschild time. And the tortoise coordinate radial variable r star is r minus 2m plus this extra factor here. Now, we should anticipate some trouble with this. Because on one hand, since t star is t, we would expect that inside the Schwarzschild black hole, the t variable, or the t star variable, is again becoming space-like. So we haven't solved that problem. But it gets worse. Because in Bob's coordinates, this radial variable r star doesn't seem to be well defined inside the light cone, sorry, inside the horizon. Because if r is smaller than 2m, so if we are inside the black hole, then this is smaller than 1, this is negative, and then we have to take the logarithm of a negative number. So we can't do this. In fact, that's unavoidable. And it turns out that this map is okay and it is invertible, but only outside the horizon. So Bob's coordinate system is workable, but you can only use it up until the horizon from the outside. But it's not a coordinate system inside the horizon. It's only good to describe part of the spacetime, of the Schwarzschild spacetime. You can only describe the outside of the black hole. But as far as Bob is concerned, once Alice has crossed the horizon, she might as well have left the universe, right? Okay, so Bob's coordinate system has limited applicability. So we are always assuming here that r is larger than 2m. The tortoise coordinate system is only good outside the black hole. And how does the metric look like there? Well, outside the black hole, in Bob's tortoise coordinate system, the metric looks like this. It's dt star squared minus dr squared. So that's again the Minkowski metric, eta mu nu. And the prefactor, the scalar prefactor in Bob's coordinate system is this one. Again, in order to write this down explicitly as a function of r star, we have to invert this function of r. Right? So we have to solve that equation here for r in terms of r star, which again is non-trivial, but numerically trivial. Now let's see if it fulfills, if this coordinate system fulfills Bob's demands. Well, Bob just wanted that the coordinate system is such that the metric takes the form of a scalar prefactor times the Minkowski metric, and it ought to become the Minkowski metric in form when capital R becomes very large, when we are very far away from the black hole. And we see this obviously when little r becomes very large, so we are very far away from the black hole, then this just becomes dt squared minus dr squared. Now, how does the universe look like, at least the outside of the black hole, how does that look like from Bob's perspective? So from Bob's perspective, there is the r star variable and there's the t star variable. And r star is everywhere space-like and t star is everywhere time-like. And for r star going to minus infinity, we are approaching the horizon of the black hole. So for Bob, the horizon is not at the finite place. It's infinitely far away at negative r stars. And if Bob were to start freely falling, Bob would follow a trajectory like this. Far away from the black hole, Bob starts at rest, therefore is traveling initially only forward in time. That's why the trajectory starts vertically, because the metric also takes the form of the Minkowski metric. So it starts out vertically, then accelerates and accelerates and just keeps going forever on the way to the horizon. But never has never a trajectory that's any shallower than 45 degrees, because all light cones are again at 45 degrees, because the metric takes the form of a scalar prefactor times the Minkowski metric. Now Bob again uses light cone coordinates, defines one light cone coordinate as the difference between his time and space variable, and another light cone variable to be the sum of the two. The metric can be expressed in terms of the light cone variables, of course, and then we have, instead of dt star squared minus dr squared, dr star squared, we have this product of the differentials of the light cone coordinates. And in this case, we can again study the action of a scalar massless Klein-Gordon field, for example. This again is the general formulation of the action of such a Klein-Gordon field. And in particular, in the tortoise coordinates of Bob, it takes this form. And if we choose now the light cone coordinates of Bob, then the action takes this form. And we obtain the equation of motion in simply that form again, which is ready for quantization. Now, do black holes actually possess a singularity?
Remember, we studied all of those things as a preparation to have the terminology and definitions to consider singularity theorems for black holes. Let me start out by looking at the two closest black holes, no, the two closest galactic-sized black holes. So there's Sagittarius A star, which is a 4 million stellar mass black hole at the center of our galaxy. And that's an actual picture. This is how this looks like. We can't really see the black hole, but we can see its neighborhood. And that's over here. Actually, the Event Horizon Telescope collaboration has taken pictures also of Sagittarius A. But they are not published yet. So Sagittarius A is only 26,000 light years away from us at the center of our galaxy. You can't see it from here. You would have to travel to the southern hemisphere because the center of our galaxy is only visible south of the equator. Now, the Event Horizon Telescope has been trying to image a black hole and says that they have succeeded. And you, of course, have heard of this, that they imaged the black hole M87, the galaxy Messier 87. And that's the picture that they took of it. Where, of course, we don't see the singularity. This is a photon sphere around the horizon of it. The idea being that this black part is a shadow of the actual horizon. So we don't have any direct evidence of the existence of a singularity at the center of the black hole. Observationally, our aim is to understand the horizon of black holes better by mapping it, by measuring it. You may wonder, why is it that the Event Horizon Telescope collaboration first took a picture of Messier 87, which is much further away than Sagittarius A, which is right in our galaxy? This is a neighbor galaxy. This is in our galaxy. Does anybody know the answer? Well, it's because this black hole is way bigger than the one at our galaxy, so that the angular sizes are actually comparable. The angular sizes of the black hole M87 in the sky, the opening angle of its horizon from our perspective is about the same as that of Sagittarius A. But Sagittarius A, because it is smaller, has stuff happening faster, whereas M87, being bigger, has things happening more slowly. And in order to take a picture like this, you basically have to keep your camera open for a long time. And it is a bit as if you were taking a picture of a flame. Let's say you have a fireplace and you have some logs of fire, logs of wood on fire, and you take a picture of that, let's say from really far away, then you have to keep the lens of your camera open for a long time to collect enough photons. But you see, if the flames are flickering too fast, then you just see mush. You just see some red and orange glow. But you don't see the actual flame. And it's similar here, in that here the flames, or that's not really flames, but you know, the change in the photon emissions is faster here than it is there. So you can take, so it's easier to take a picture here when you have a long opening time of your telescope. But they're working on imaging this as well, or so they might come up with a video, rather than just a still image, an average still image there for that. We will have to see. It should come out in a few months.
So how can we model the properties of black holes? Remember, we want singularity theorems, which tell us that under certain circumstances, it's unavoidable that a black hole will form that has a singularity, at least on the grounds of classical general relativity. And in the case of cosmology, we know what the assumptions were. The assumption was that we had some space-like hypersurface on which geodesics had at least a certain amount of expansion. So the amount of negative expansion, so they had at least a certain amount of contraction if you follow things back in time. So if the space-time was expanding at least at a certain minimum rate in some space-like hypersurface, and you made some assumptions about, you know, the strong energy condition and so on, then you could prove that there must have been a singularity in the finite past. For singularity theorems for black holes, things are slightly different. And an important concept there that goes into the assumption of singularity theorems is the concept of a trapped surface. So what is that? Let's assume that sigma is a space-like hypersurface. And being a space-like hypersurface, it will be three-dimensional because we are working with a 3+1-dimensional space-time. Now, let's assume that T, a subset of sigma, is a compact two-dimensional smooth space-like submanifold of sigma. So that could be like a two-dimensional sphere around a black hole, for example. So we have a three-dimensional space-like hypersurface sigma, and we have a two-dimensional compact two-dimensional smooth space-like submanifold of sigma. So it's going to be space-like as well. And now we consider the ingoing and the outgoing future-directed null geodesics that are orthogonal to T. Okay, so we have this surface, and we have geodesics that go in and out. And we are looking at the future-directed geodesics that go in and future-directed geodesics that go out. It can happen that all these geodesics possess negative expansion. All of them lead to a contraction. All of them, you know, converge towards each other. All of the future-directed geodesics converge towards each other, no matter in which direction you try to escape from that surface. If that's so, then that surface is called a trapped surface. This doesn't happen outside a black hole, but it can happen inside a black hole. So let's consider the Schwarzschild black hole again in Alice's favorite coordinate system, the Kruskal-Szekeres coordinate system. Here, let's consider a sphere of R equal constant. Now, it doesn't look like a sphere in this diagram. It's going to look like a point, right? Because we just choose the radius, like here, for example, and then it's the angles that define this to be a sphere. Okay, so we can choose a point here, and that's going to be a point of constant R. Remember the light cones? Here are the light cones. So if you're here, then a point here describes all of the sphere. Then in whichever direction you want to go, here or there, you're going to approach the singularity. And it turns out that in this case, geodesics always converge towards each other in both directions, in each direction that you may want to go. You're heading towards a singularity no matter what you do. So you could be standing somewhere there, and you have two laser beams,
and you shoot them this way or that way or that way or that way, right? You shoot them towards the future, but in any direction you want, and these beams are always going to converge and go towards the black hole's singularity.
Generally, it looks like this. This is the Penrose diagram again for a black hole. Remember, we had this a few lectures back. Minkowski space would be the full triangle, but we have a black hole here. And remember, then it means that this piece is chopped off. Here's the singularity of the black hole, and here's the event horizon. Remember why that is the event horizon. As a traveler, having mass, you can travel any trajectory like this, as long as your tangent is not shallower than 45 degrees, because it's got to be in the forward light cone. And so at some point here, you have to make a decision. Are you going to travel this way and hit the singularity of the black hole, or are you going to go that way and escape to future time-like infinity? If you go to future time-like infinity, if your trajectory goes like this and you end up over here, then what is your event horizon? The event horizon is the boundary of your causal past. Right? So you take this trajectory and you look at its causal past, and that's all of the events over here, all of this. Right? But events in here are not in the causal past of that, because nothing in here can affect you over there. So your event horizon, being the boundary of your causal past, is this line. All right. Now, let's take some object on the surface of the star that collapsed to become a black hole and track its path. Its path is going to go like this, so on. An infalling spherical shell that will create a black hole. Now, imagine you are somewhere on that spherical shell in here. Then, again, you can send light rays in opposite directions, but it doesn't matter. You always have to hit the singularity. So that means you'll be, if you're here, you'll be on a trapped surface. And over there, you're on a trapped surface, and so on. Everywhere in there, you're going to be on a trapped surface, because it doesn't matter in which direction you go. The geodesics that you emit will contract and they will hit the singularity. Now, it's not obvious that they will have this contraction instead of expansion. You have to calculate that. But what we can see is that you're heading towards the singularity no matter which direction you travel. So, let us now consider again a space-like hypersurface. Remember, that's three-dimensional. It's like a point in time. Then the union, let's call it tau, of all trapped surfaces is called the trapped region of your space-like hypersurface. So in the picture that we just had, in this case, every point in here corresponds to a sphere which is a trapped surface. And so the union of all those forms everything here, right? All of this in this triangle there. So the union of all the trapped surfaces is called the trapped region of the space-like hypersurface. Then the boundary del tau, which is part of our space-like hypersurface sigma, is called the apparent horizon of the space-like hypersurface sigma. Now, the boundary of the trapped region is two-dimensional and is space-like. I mean, everything in sigma is space-like, so it has to be space-like. So the apparent horizon is two-dimensional and space-like. Now assume that we foliate our space-time, like a stack of pancakes, into space-like hypersurfaces. Let's call them sigma alpha. And each of these might have an apparent horizon, T alpha. Then the union of these apparent horizons is called the trapping horizon of the space-time. Now, why going into those definitions? There are two reasons. One is that they're going to be useful for the formulation of black hole singularity theorem. And the other is that conceptually, apparent horizons are more workable than event horizons. Because the notion of an event horizon is teleological. You would need to know all of the future in order to determine where an event horizon is. It's easy to say if you just write down a Penrose diagram and then look at a path that takes you all the way to future time-like infinity, and then you look at your causal past and the boundary of it. But in practice, of course, you can't operate like this as a cosmologist or astrophysicist because you don't know the future. You can only tell where an event horizon was looking back from future infinity. That's not very practical. So to check for the existence of an event horizon, you have to take the world line on which you travel, or with respect to which you want to know about the existence of an event horizon, you have to take that world line all the way to future time-like infinity, I plus. Then you look at its causal past, the minus, and then you look at the boundary of that. That's the event horizon by definition. And it requires, in principle, knowledge of the full future. However, one can check for the existence of an apparent horizon in any space-like hypersurface by calculating the expansion of geodesics at that time. So you can just go in there and do the measurement, do the experiment. Are the geodesics going to drift apart or not? The only drawback is that the notion of apparent horizon is dependent on the choice of foliation of the space-time into space-like hypersurfaces, which is something that can sometimes be an issue. Now, for static Schwarzschild black holes, the event horizon and the apparent horizons coincide, as we saw. And now the last thing I'm going to mention today is that singularity theorems for black holes make assumptions about apparent horizons. You see, it would be foolish to make assumptions about event horizons because you would need to know all the future. And so while for cosmological singularities, for cosmological singularity theorems, we had to make assumptions about the rate of expansion or shrinkage of the universe on some space-like hypersurface. Here, we will have to make assumptions about the existence of apparent horizons. And then the existence of apparent horizons, again with energy conditions, can be used to infer that geodesics, future geodesics, come to an end at a finite proper time of the geodesics. And therefore, you can prove that there is going to be a singularity at the center of the black hole. Another thing that is related and that we might address in the course next term when we study Hawking radiation is that when we say that a black hole emits Hawking radiation, then often one takes the naive picture that it is the event horizon from which Hawking photons are being emitted. Now, when you look more closely, you find that in the literature, the general view is that it's actually the apparent horizons that emit the radiation. But let me just close with the warning that while there are lots of controversial things about this, for example, if you're interested, look at work by George Ellis, who makes the point that when a black hole is growing, then there ought not be any Hawking radiation, because if you view Hawking radiation as a tunneling process, it would have to tunnel over space-like distance, which it cannot. Details don't matter. The point is that there is still a lot of controversy about where exactly Hawking radiation emanates from. And that's a pretty important question, because one of the key questions in black hole physics is whether or not Hawking radiation takes information of what fell into the black hole out with it. But then, regarding the question where Hawking radiation emanates, whether it is apparent horizons or event horizons, we should also keep in mind how big the Hawking photons are. Anybody know how big they are? What their typical wavelength is? You know?
Depends where.
Yes, that's right. But let's say far out. I mean, if you're directly at the horizon, then of course it's enormously blue shifted. But as soon as you are an appreciable distance away from the black hole, because this blue shift decays very, very quickly as you go away from the black hole. And you look at the temperature of the Hawking radiation from the outside, then you can look at the black hole spectrum that is being emitted, and you can, from the temperature, you can infer where the maximum of the radiation is. And these photons have as their typical wavelength, so the most emitted wavelength in Hawking radiation is the size of the black hole. So if, for example, our sun was heavier than it is by a factor of 2 or so, then it would eventually have to end up in a black hole. And then it would have a Schwarzschild radius of a few kilometers. And that means that the Hawking radiation that it would emit has a typical wavelength of a few kilometers. Now, thermal radiation from the sun, who has a surface of 6,000 Kelvin temperature, that thermal radiation has a peak in the green. So that is, what, 500 nanometers or so. So 500 nanometers is the typical wavelength of photons that have about 6,000 Kelvin, that emanate from a surface of 6,000 Kelvin. So you can imagine how cold such a black hole would be when the sun turns into a black hole. Because then the wavelength will no longer be 500 nanometers. It would be more like 5 kilometers. So by that factor, right? So you go from 500 nanometers is 5 × 10⁻⁷ to 5 × 10�³. So it's a factor of 10 to the 10. So it would be 10 to the minus 10 times 6,000, so it would be like a 10 millionth of a Kelvin, right? Yeah, so, all right. But in this course, we're not doing Hawking radiations. It was just a comment. And I'm glad today I'm actually finishing on time.
Okay, so we have one more lecture coming up on Tuesday. Okay? Any questions?
Now, if we had one more lecture, which we sometimes have in some years, it depends on the arrangement of the holidays, then I would give another lecture on results that I published together with two students who took this class earlier, following up on something that we discussed after class. I think I will just post a link to that work. You can have a look into that.